Greetings again, friends and brethren. I hope this finds everyone doing well. If you need a title today for this message, it is The Waking Up Process. The Waking Up Process. And so what I want to try to emphasize today in this short period of time is that waking up is a process. It's waking up out of this later sin condition that God's people have fallen in. And it is a process. And there's a time for this country that is our nations of Israel, our countries, will also have to go through a waking up process, and it's going to be a horrendous time when that happens. But God's people are given a special opportunity now, because we are being judged now, to wake up and be corrected now, or, as I've said many times, later in the Great Tribulation. But the waking up is a process. It's not something that happens instantly all at one time. And I get emails and phone calls from people around the country and around the world that come across our website, and they say, "Thank you for waking me up," or "I'm glad to be finally awake now," and you know, comments like that. And that's all fine and well, and this is not to be judgmental against anyone. I'm just basing what I'm going to say on my experience, and maybe I'm the only one, I don't know, but I do know that this waking up that many are going through, or beginning to go through, is a process, and it doesn't all happen instantaneously at one time. But yet, to some degree, in one way it does. And I can give you an analogy of that, and that is what Mr. Armstrong wrote about the conversion process. And there is a time, and this is kind of an analogy between us waking up today and then the conversion process itself. So there is a time in our conversion that it does happen to some degree all at once, and that's when our, you know, when we have that mind change to turn and go the other way, and to walk with Christ and to dedicate ourselves to that life. So that generally leads to baptism and our walk in the Christian life. So in one sense, there is a type, or in a smaller scale, a conversion that takes place all at once. But then, as Mr. Armstrong wrote, and it's very true, that conversion is a lifelong process. See, it takes a whole lifetime of overcoming and striving to live God's way. And still, even at the moment of our death, we're not perfect. But yet, even though we may qualify for God's kingdom, because see, He's going to complete that work in us. So, with the waking up process, it's the same way. So, and you go back and listen to some of these messages that I gave early on, and that's really what it's about. And I've learned a lot since then, see, myself. So it's really coming to a point in time in this Laodicean time period when we do realize that we've got to get back to that foundation of truth, that all things that Christ says in Matthew 17, verse 11, that would be restored by His end time Elijah. So we realize suddenly, to some degree, that we have to get back to that. And so that is sort of a sudden wake-up call in one sense. But you have to realize, too, at least in my case, I don't think it's humanly possible to get back to all those things at once and be suddenly awake to every truth and doctrine that was restored into the church, Mr. Armstrong. And the reason why is because we've gone through so many years of polluted doctrine. So what we have to do is go through a process of unlearning, see, some of that garbage, and get those spiritual cobwebs out of our minds that are false truths or deceit, and then take one doctrine and truth at a time. And that's what I've tried to do through this website, and it's a process. So there is, in a way, there is a sudden awakening when you realize suddenly that you've been deceived or duped, and you've got to get back to that foundation of truth that God revealed through His end-time apostle. But then as we do that, it's a process. We can't do it all at once. We can get a lot of it at once, and when we begin to realize what we've got to get back to, but we do have to realize it's a process, and it takes a little time to do that. But even then, we may never get completely or fully awake. You know, whatever I mentioned in the last message, what does that mean to be fully awake? Only Christ knows. And there's many people that have died in the faith over the years that didn't have all that truth that we've been blessed with in these last two eras of God's church, and yet they qualified for God's kingdom, see? It was based on what they did with what knowledge they had. So Same with us. We have to earnestly try to contend for that faith once delivered to the church, to the saints, and that's what we do. So, to begin with, please turn to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. And then we've covered this verse hundreds of times, but just want to point out one thing of it. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 18. This is, if you have a red letter Bible, Jesus Christ speaking here. He says, I counsel you, see, you brethren, me and you, to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich in white garments. See, that's indicative of righteousness or right doing. That you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve. And why? That you may see. So today, many of God's people don't see. Why? Because they are in a state of a spiritual slumber or sleep, as we'll touch on here momentarily. So in order to be able to see, you have to open your eyes. See, you have to be awake and alert. So it's a process that goes on there. But it's interesting, he points out here that that by those white garments, because that's indicative of righteousness or right doing. And today, many of God's people are not doing right, even though they think they are, or think they're holding fast. But then he concludes by saying, anoint your eyes with the eye salve so you can see. So Christ is wanting us here in this end era to see something, to see this condition that we've fallen into. And again, it doesn't all come at once, because if God ever let us, like somebody mentioned years ago, if God ever did let us truly see ourselves like we are, we probably wouldn't be able to handle it and make us sick. So it's a process, and we can thank God for that, for his mercy and grace. So turn to Luke chapter 21, and we'll look at something here. And this has something to do with the waking up process, especially here in this end time. And notice what it says in Luke chapter 21, beginning in verse 34. You can break this down to several little commands here, but it says in verse 34, take heed to yourselves. See, what's the first thing? Take heed to yourselves, brethren, Christ is saying to me and you, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that in that day come upon you unexpectedly. He's talking about his return. But it's interesting, take note of this last admonition here in verse 34. Carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life. See, think about what that means for a moment in our individual lives, in what we see in happening in the churches of God today, when they're getting more and more out of the doctrine of Jesus Christ and into the false doctrines of this world. They're becoming more and more caught up in the cares of this life. And so what's going to happen is that warning, he says, that day is going to come upon you unexpectedly. And why is that? Because they're not watching, see? They're not alert, not awake. Notice verse 35. But again, in verse 34, we should think about that little phrase. Certainly all the rest of it, too, the carousing and drunkenness, and that's physical and spiritual drunkenness. And that's a major problem today with many of God's people. They're drunk with wine, but not the alcoholic type. It's spiritual wine, see? So they're in the delusion, a strong delusion, as it says there in 2 Thessalonians. But the cares of this life is something we need to think about, because it affects every one of us. If we get caught up in our daily activities and our daily jobs and whatever we do during the day, during the course of a week, and we can be distracted. See, and God wants us to get our minds off of that and think about something bigger. And we'll touch on that here in a little while, But notice verse 35, for it will come as a snare on all, not just some, but all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. See, brethren, that's all. When God says all, he means all. So it's going to, when things begin to happen, it's going to happen suddenly, as I've said many times. And Mr. Armstrong also said that. He was very urgent, always, in the work of God. And a snare, see, it's going to come as a snare, something that snaps shut suddenly upon its prey, or trap, see. It's going to come as a snare, which means suddenly or very quickly, without warning or notice, on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Verse 36, and here's an admonition. Watch, therefore, and pray. Now, stop there momentarily. What does it mean to watch? Well, in order to watch, you have to have your eyes open, see, You have to be awake and you have to be alert. So we can't even watch unless we are in that state. We got to be alert and awake. Have your eyes open. See, Christ says there, I just read at the beginning, to anoint your eyes so that you can see. So watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. So that's a good admonition there of something that plays a big part in this waking up process. We have to be awake and alert, have our eyes open, and we watch world events. And there are many things happening on a daily basis. I get emails from brethren, from little here, little there, and it's amazing how they all fit together of things that are happening to fulfill prophecy in this world, in the news. So that's one of the things we have to get back to, is watching, and watching with extreme spiritual awareness of what this means in the big picture, as prophecy is being put together piece by piece. And at some point, it's going to begin to do like verse 35. It's going to come as a snare. It's just going to all snap together real quick. Mr. Armstrong warned us of that over and over. Notice now, Matthew 25, something we've covered before many times, but just want to add a little different perspective on it, perhaps. Matthew 25, notice verse 5. It says, this is Christ again saying this, but while the bridegroom was delayed, they all, see, A-L-L, slumbered and slept. And I've always put the emphasis on the all to show that it did happen to all of God's people, and some are waking up. But notice the word slumbered and slept. See, why didn't it just say you slept? Well, because Christ says they slumbered and slept. And I looked both of those up, and they, in the concordance, and they do mean exactly what they say, slumber and sleep. The word slumbered means to nod or nod off and to drift into sleep. And the word slept means exactly that, to sleep. But see, when you go into, when something happens to begin to wake you up, and we all have different stories, and when we come to the feast every year, it's interesting to share those stories of what has happened to us in this Laodicean time period to cause us to begin to wake up. Sometimes it's been a very traumatic situation that led people to wake up. Sometimes it's been a gradual process. But I'll give you a physical analogy. I was discussing this on the phone yesterday actually, with Mr. Leary over in England. But, you know, it's like when you are laying on your bed sleeping, and there's a point in time when you begin to stir and open your eyes and begin to wake up. But you don't become fully alert all at once, do you? See, you open your eyes. So at that point, you can say you're awake. See, that's the point when you actually are awake, but you're not fully awake yet. So that's like I was mentioning earlier with this waking up process spiritually. So when you're laying in bed physically and your eyes first come open or you stir, you open your eyes, you're awake, but you're not fully alert yet. So you sit up on the edge of your bed, for example, and you may sit there for a minute or two and you're kind of groggy a little bit, and you're a little bit more awake than you were just a few minutes before when you were laying down. But you're still kind of groggy, see, and you're not fully awake yet. So you may sit there for a minute and try to clear the cobwebs out, so to speak, and then you get up and you may, you know, kind of stumble into the bathroom and splash some water on your face and brush your teeth, and now you're a little bit more awake, see, but maybe not quite fully awake yet. So maybe you have to go in the kitchen and make you a cup of java or coffee or a cup of tea, as our British friends do, and drink a little something hot and maybe some juice, and then you find yourself kind of energizing and you're a little bit more awake, but maybe you're not quite perhaps fully awake yet. So maybe you take a little walk outside, you throw your clothes on, and maybe you walk out to your mailbox or go out and pick up the paper and stretch and get a breath of fresh air. Now you're beginning to wake up a little more, see. So as this little process goes on, you can see there's an analogy even with the spiritual life we have, that you don't necessarily wake up all at one time. It takes a little time. And that's all I'm trying to present here. But there's things that happen occasionally that we have to kind of remind ourselves of, and that's part of what this website is, part of the warning to God's people that we need to get back to. One good example, there's actually a couple of good examples I want to have touch on if I have time, but one good example of this is understanding the spiritual law, see, the spiritual law of God. And that those truths and doctrines, Mr. Armstrong covered us many times, but I don't think it sunk into many of our heads over the years. I know it didn't mine for a long time, because I'm a thick-headed Israelite, see. It takes time for things, but I thought about this over the past several years. I just haven't had an opportunity to address it, but take the doctrines and truths that God restored into the church under Mr. Armstrong in the Philadelphia era. Well, he addressed this, that those become part of the spiritual law, see, part of the keeping of God's law. So here's an example. I'm sitting here in front of my computer, and I'm looking at this article that I put up some time ago, The Makeup Cover-Up, and it's about, and the title of the article Mr. Armstrong wrote is How Subtly Satan Used Makeup to Start the Church Off Track. And then he goes on through this article and shows how this and all the doctrines and truth that have come into the church under his authority as God's apostle become part of keeping the spiritual law of God, and it's for a reason. So that's one good example. I'll just read part of my little introduction to it. It says, many ministers today throughout the churches of God are covering up the importance of the makeup doctrine that was set in place in God's church by God's end-time apostle. Many say it's a non-issue or just a minor doctrine. Others say it should just be a matter of individual choice. The vast majority of these churches are allowing makeup. Some have boldly done away with this doctrine, while others don't dare to even bring it up. Is makeup really just a minor doctrine? Do we not realize that there are no minor doctrines in the Church of God? Indeed, all the doctrines placed into God's church are major and all equally important, and are placed there for a reason. Mr. Armstrong felt it was important enough to preach on it frequently when God was using him to put the church back on track doctrinally in the early 1980s. In the article posted below, Mr. Armstrong shows how Satan used this doctrine to get the church off track. So it must be more than just a minor or insignificant doctrine. And it's evident that God himself feels that it's important because he inspired his apostle to set the doctrine straight once and for all. Remember, only God's apostles have the authority to change or place doctrine into God's church, and God binds that decision in heaven. Then it is up to us as members of God's church to remain faithful to that doctrine or not. I'll pause from reading. That goes with any doctrine, too, brethren. Continue reading. It really all comes down to understanding and respecting the authority of God's apostles and following God's government. Many today, I'll pause there because it includes more than that. It also includes faith. It's a matter of testing our faith, see, in following government. Many today reason around this by using any number of excuses. Some may even use a scholarly approach, saying that they have new understanding of the scriptures. Some say that Mr. Armstrong was mistaken in this judgment he made on makeup, and that it's outdated, and that we have to now get up to date with the modern times. Whatever the reason or excuse is, there is no excuse. God Almighty placed this doctrine, all the doctrines, into his church through his apostles, and they are still binding today. Do we have the right to pick and choose which doctrine or truth we will believe or hold on to? Of course not. Excuse me. That is exactly what Satan wants, a divided church. And guess what? He's got it. So as a reminder of what God inspired Mr. Armstrong to teach on this, I am posting the below article. Of course, Mr. Armstrong covered this in other writings and sermons, but this particular article, even in the title, shows how important this doctrine is. And see, that title was How Subtly Satan Used Makeup, see, supposedly an insignificant doctrine, he used makeup to start the church off the track. So then proceeds the article, and it's a very good article, and I would admonish anyone to read it, not just because of the makeup subject, but because of the principles that Mr. Armstrong covers in this article about doctrines and truths that Christ revealed into the church through him. And that becomes part of keeping the spiritual law of God, see? It's part of the law then. So there are things that have been directives and decisions made by God's end-time apostle placed into the church, which become doctrine and truths, that by not doing them are keeping the law, and there's some things by doing them you're keeping the law. See, a physical action or not a physical action. So, like, for example, we take the dietary laws in the Leviticus 11 there, and that's a physical thing and has to do with our physical bodies. But if we begin to break those intentionally or willfully, then it becomes a spiritual matter. Why? Because it's a matter of a decision we made in our mind to violate intentionally, and then it becomes a spiritual matter, see, in that case. But let me see. There's also another principle, for example, we touch on, and that's tithing, tithing laws, because there are some today that say that tithing is not a law and it's unscriptural. Well, that's hogwash. The Bible is full of it, and Mr. Armstrong wrote many booklets and articles on that over the years. I'm going to touch on one here in just a moment. Actually, I think I'll just do that now. I have an article here printed off earlier. It's from the Good News of Tomorrow's World, personal from Mr. Armstrong, February 1971, and he begins off talking about how the economy was not looking very good at that time. That was just before that first oil crisis our country had, leading into that time period. On the second page of it, there, under the subtitle, "How Your Future Is Determined," I want to touch on something. And he says here, "How your future is determined. Yes, and your own personal economic future is determined by definite laws. Very few realize that the eternal Creator set in motion invisible yet inexorable laws which regulate personal financial conditions. In my 40 years in God's ministry," remember this was written in 71, "I have seen these laws actively work in the experiences of many people who I have known personally. I've experienced their relentless working in my own life." Pause from reading. Yeah, you can read the autobiography and find many, many things that happened there as Mr. Armstrong was in the learning process. And again, I always emphasize to people, if you want to learn, the Bible talks a lot about what faith is and gives many examples, but if you want to get a detailed writing of how to live by faith or an example of it, read Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, because it's all documented in detail. Continue reading. I have experienced in their relentless working in my own life, that's about God's laws. I had to learn this lesson the hard way myself. I have often mentioned on the air in articles in The Plain Truth how God struck me down, not physically but economically, to bring me to Him. That very depression of 1920 destroyed my business, in which I was making the equivalent of $35,000 a year in today's money. Everything I touched turned not to gold like King Midas, but to loss of and lack of money. It was in poverty and hunger that God actually conquered me and turned me to Him, giving my life to Him over 40 years ago. But even after conversion, and even after my ordination as a minister of Jesus Christ in 1931, see, after this, our family was still on the economic rocks. I had begun to learn something about God's law of tithing as a biblical doctrine. Pause from reading. So here, Mr. Armstrong makes a statement, God's apostle, that God, it says here, God's law of tithing as a biblical doctrine. So what I want to emphasize here, for those who may doubt, that tithing is not an option for God's people. It is not an option to whether you just decide to do it or not. If you don't do it, then you're violating God's laws. See, it's not an option. It's a law. It's part of God's laws, friends and brethren. So he says, I'd begun to learn something about God's law of tithing as a Bible doctrine. I had studied it in the Bible. I had learned, seen, proved that this law was still in effect. Yet, in those early years, it didn't seem to apply to me. I had seen it as a doctrine to accept as true, but not as a law which I personally must obey. How many of you are right now like I was then? A break from reading, because I'm going to go over to the next page. That's a good question for all of us. Now, the next page is subtitles. I'm not reading this whole article for sake of time. I'm just hitting the highlights, but on the subtitle here, "How I Learned the Lesson." Skipping down, he says, "We had frequently gone hungry before I was converted. Now we went hungry even more frequently." See, after he was converted. "Then one day it dawned on my mind that we ourselves were actually breaking God's financial law by not tithing." See, he knew he was breaking God's laws. All of a sudden, he says, God made me see His financial law was something personal, not merely a doctrine to accept impersonally. It meant me. See, he took it personally. That very day, I took 10% of what we had, and it was not enough to buy food. I added an offering and mailed it to the church treasury. That very afternoon, food came for a completely adequate meal. I don't remember how, but I do remember that the very day that I repented for not having accepted tithing as a personal obligation instead of a mere doctrinal argument, that very day food came. Now, God, he says, God did not bring us immediate financial prosperity. See, something to think about. God did not bring us immediate financial prosperity for some years more, for our own good. See, that's why he still was learning, for our own good. We were forced to live in very poor economic circumstances, but that very day, our financial condition started upward. Okay, I'll drop down for sake of time here. He says further down, he goes, now don't get the idea from this that it, because he gave some examples of some brethren that had sent him stories of how they were blessed from tithing. And he says that further down, he don't get the idea from this that in every case God is going to work some incredible miracle. Don't get the idea that if you try tithing, you are to expect some astounding thing to happen. See, that'll be paused there, but because he had put the word try in bold letters. See, he says, don't get the idea that if you just try tithing, you are to expect some astounding thing to happen. Well, if you're just trying it, it's not going to work. See, because your heart has to be in it. See, Christ says, where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. I'll read on that later. So if your heart's not in it, there's no sense of trying it. You might as well not even try. So he says, don't get the idea that if you try tithing, you are to expect some astounding thing to happen, or that you are going to fall heir to millions of dollars the next day. Perhaps in most cases, the increase in income is not immediately apparent at all. But of this, you may be sure. Over the long haul, the 90% of income that God allows you to keep for yourself will increase to more than the 100% formerly was. God promises to bless and prosper the tither. God keeps his promise. And then this next little subtitle is just, I'm just going to read the first sentence. It says, there's a reason. See, there's a reason for these tithing laws. Mr. Armstrong says, God did not establish a binding law of tithing. That's interesting the way he puts that. God did not establish a binding law of tithing without a good reason. Actually, there are many reasons. All of God's laws are for our good. Okay, I'll pause from reading. That'll be the end of reading from that because he covers some scriptures which I'm going to touch on here momentarily. But turn, for example, to Malachi chapter 3. We've covered this before, but I'd like to just point something out in it that's interesting that I may have not touched on before. Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, and beginning in verse 8, it says, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? And he goes on to say, in tithes and offerings. But let's look at that first sentence again in verse 8. Will a man rob God? And yet he says, you have robbed me. Well, look at that word rob. That means to steal, see? And isn't that one of God's commandments right there? Thou shalt not steal? See? So that's a breaking. So that's a proof right there that this is a law of God. Because if you've robbed God from tithes and offerings, then you've stolen. And you've broken that commandment, see? So this is something to think about. Verse 9, it says, you are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me. See, there we go again. That's the third time that's mentioned. That's stealing. Even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this. Now, look at that sentence. Try me now. God is asking us to try him, because there's a blessing in this for us if we do. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not even be room enough to receive it. That is a promise from Almighty God, brethren, that he will bless us. Doesn't say he's going to make us rich or wealthy, but he definitely, as Mr. Armstrong just stated, that it will make up for much more than that 10%. And then if you're in a third tithe here, that first and third tithe. But God is giving a promise here, if we will stop robbing him and try him. God says, try me now. He's challenging us. So people today think that they can't possibly make it if they tithe. I remember reading an article Mr. Armstrong wrote about the man who couldn't afford to tithe. And he showed an example there of the man who couldn't do it. And so Mr. Armstrong challenged him on that. And there was actually a couple of situations like that in the autobiography. And so it's interesting how it doesn't look like you can actually do it on paper. I've gone through this over almost 34, 35 years now in God's church. There have been times, especially in a third tithe year, but even with the first tithe, I didn't think I could physically do it. Just doesn't look like we can do it. But I did it, and it worked, because God always provides a way. So that's why he says, try me now and see if I don't work a miracle for you. Open the store windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. So that is a promise from God, and we should, and he's asking us to try him. So he's standing there waiting and willing to perform this miracle for us if we'll just do our part. That's a promise from Almighty God. He's the creator of all. Notice now, Psalms. What I wanted to do is just to put the emphasis now on the fact that tithing is a law. All these doctrines are part of God's law, whether it's makeup or the truths and doctrines that were restored into God's church, all of them, all of those truths and doctrines, and in addition to, of course, the Ten Commandments, which are the basic outline of a law. And as Mr. Armstrong, that's one thing I was going to point out in this article down here. I'm still on my computer. Let me see if I can find it. Okay. Yeah, I thought it's just a short paragraph. It's in this makeup article. Mr. Armstrong says, Jesus, for example, magnified the law and made it honorable. At Mount Sinai, he, as Yahweh, expanded it into 10 points. The first four, defining the principle of love toward God. The last six, love toward neighbor. From there, see, now notice, from there it expands in principle to cover any and every question that may arise. Pause from reading. Isn't that profound? See, from there it expands in principle, the law of God, to cover any and every question that may arise. So that's why I say all those truths and doctrines, and Mr. Armstrong clearly outlines this in this article on makeup. So you can take those principles and apply them to all those truths and doctrines that were restored to all things, see, of Matthew 17, verse 11, which Jesus Christ commanded us, the last command he gave to that Philadelphia era, to hold fast to what you have, so that no man take your crown. Well, we failed to do it as God's people. So now we're waking up and getting back to it, see? And that's good. That's good. Now notice, please, turn to referring to God's law here. Psalms 119. Psalms 119. This is a beautiful chapter, and it's also a very huge chapter. I'm not going to cover it all. I don't have time. It would take me a couple hours just to go through just this one chapter, but let's just touch on some verses here because it ties into God's law and the waking up process to some degree. And it's the question we should ask ourselves here as we go through this: how much do we love God's law as we begin to wake up and cling back to these truths and doctrines and all of God's laws? How much do we love it? See? But notice in beginning in verse 1 of Psalms 119, it says, blessed are the undefiled. This is the New King James here. Blessed are the undefiled in the way. See, in what way is that? See, who walk in the law of the eternal. That's the way. But verse 2, blessed are those who keep his testimonies, who seek him with the whole heart. See, do we do that today? Verse 3, they also do no iniquity. They walk in his ways. You have commanded us to keep your precepts diligently. Oh, that my ways were directed to keep your statutes. Then I would not be ashamed when I look into all your commandments. See, today, if we really look with an open mind and a pure heart at God's commandments and all his laws, then we ought to be ashamed from not keeping them fully. That's the tithing law, all these doctrines and truths. We should be ashamed if we're not keeping them. That's why he says here, then I would not be ashamed. If I would do all this, he says, if I'd keep these precepts diligently. In verse 6, then I would not be ashamed when I look into all your commandments. Verse 7, I will praise you with uprightness of heart when I learn your righteous judgments. I will keep your statutes. Oh, do not forsake me utterly. So that's good admonition there, something to meditate on those verses. Notice verse 18. Drop down to verse 18. Open my eyes. Well, see, pause right there. So here we are, brethren, in the end time, in this waking up process. Hopefully we're getting more and more awake every hour and every day, and who, God only knows when we'll be fully awake or awake enough. But verse 18 here says, open my eyes. So he knew he had a problem. He needed to see more. This is where our attitude should be right now. Open my eyes that I may see wondrous things from your law. See, your law, God. Drop down to verse 37. It says, turn away my eyes from looking at worthless things and revive me in your way. So let's take a look at this verse. Turn away my eyes from what? Looking at worthless things. Well, didn't I just mention in Luke 21, it put emphasis on where Christ says the cares of this life, see, those worthless things that can distract you from God's way of life and from God's truth. So here he's asking for some good help. You know, it's one thing to have your eyes open and to be waking up, but it's what do you do with them? Turn away my eyes from looking at worthless things. So there are many worthless things today in this society, even when it comes to religion. See, there's a lot of worthless things going out there, going on in this country today, but also in God's churches. Got worthless things. And so he concludes the verse, and revive me in your way. Well, many of God's people have departed from that way here in the end time. So as we wake up, we want to keep our eyes off those worthless things and be revived in God's way. Notice now, drop down to verse 63, is something that caught my eye earlier. It says, I'm a companion of all who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. So if you want to know who your companion should be or your friends, this is a clear indication of who our friends and who our fellowship should be, see. I am a companion of all who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. So if you're fellowshipping with those who are keeping God's precepts, then that's a good companion to have, see. That's the kind of companion you want. Finally, in this section, let's drop down to verse 97, because beginning here is where Mr. Dwight Armstrong was inspired to write that song, Oh, how love I your law. It is ever with me. See, you remember that song? But verse 97 says, Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. Pause from reading. Can we say that, brethren, about ourselves? Can you? Can I? See, do we meditate on God's laws, all his laws, all those doctrines and truths, that way, that all things, that way of life? Do we meditate on that all through the day, no matter what we're doing or no matter where we're at? Or are our eyes and mind, like what it says back there in verse 37, worthless things, see, on worthless things. So all those laws, all those things that I mentioned earlier, whether it's tithing or makeup or just the God's way of life in general, it should be our meditation all the day, see. Verse 98, I was just going to stop there, but we'll read verse 98. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. See those commandments. That's what they should be. And that's what we should be trying to attain, is to have those laws written in our mind and heart, and to meditate on them all the day, every day, day and night. Every waking moment. Now I know we haven't achieved that yet, but that's a great honorable admonition here from God that he inspired David to write. But I thought it was just interesting how Psalms 119, read the whole thing on your own sometime, has a lot to do with God's laws, his judgments, his statutes, his precepts, all those things that tie into God's law. It's interesting how a couple of times there that it addresses opening the eyes and being awake, see. And here we are in this waking up process, and we need to pay more attention, I think, as overall and what we're trying to wake up to. It's one thing just to wake up to some degree and realize, well, yeah, we got to get back to that foundation. Well, that's fine and well. That is the beginning of waking up. And to some degree, you are awake when you come to that decision. I speak to people all the time on the phone or emails that are coming to that, and I'm excited because the waking up process has begun. But there's more to it than just that sudden realization that you've got to wake up. Then we've got to take action, and we've got to do something. We've got to get back to all of those things, see, all of that truth, that which is, as David said, the way. Revive me in your way, God's way. Notice Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah chapter 51, and notice beginning in verse 17, Isaiah 51, chapter 51, verse 17, It says, "Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem." And of course, Jerusalem is a type of the church, so we can apply this spiritually to God's people today as well as physical Jerusalem. Awake, awake. So in, what's this command? He says it twice with the exclamation point. Well, that means somebody's asleep. When God commands you to awake, it's because someone's asleep. Stand up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of his fury. You have drunk the dregs of the cup of trembling and drained it out. There is no one to guide her among all the sons she has brought forth, nor is there any who takes her by the hand among all the sons she has brought up. These two things have come to you. Who will be sorry for you? Desolation and destruction, famine and the sword. By whom will I comfort you? So this is something that's very soon to come upon us, and that's part of the warning of this website. Verse 20, your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of all the streets like an antelope in a net. They are full of the fury of the Eternal, the rebuke of your God. Notice verse 21. Therefore, please hear this, you afflicted. See, God's saying, please hear, please listen. You afflicted and drunk, but not with wine. See, as I mentioned earlier, talking about the other verse, they're drunk, but not with wine. So that's spiritual drunkenness here we're talking about. So that narrows it down, begins to narrow down to who he is addressing. See, notice verse 22. Thus says your Lord, the Eternal and your God, who pleads the cause of his people. See, his people. See, I have taken out of your hand the cup of trembling, the dregs of the cup of my fury. You shall no longer drink it. That is verse 23. But I will put it into the hand of those who afflict you. This is a promise. Who have said to you, lie down that we may walk over you. And you have laid your body like the ground and as the street for those who walk over. So that's a promise of what God's going to do for his people in the end time after they've been trodden down. See? And caught in this captivity. Notice what it says, continuing, you know, that should be a continuation here and no chapter breaks. So notice chapter 52 and verse 1. He says it again, awake, awake. So this time he says Zion, see, put on your strength, Zion, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments. Well, that's those garments that Christ is referring to there that I mentioned at the beginning, Revelation 3:18, those garments that indicate righteousness. O Jerusalem, the holy city. See, who is that? See, the holy city. For the uncircumcised and the unclean shall no longer come to you. Shake yourself off from the dust. Arise, sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the bonds of your neck. O captive daughter of Zion. That's God's church. So God's warning us to wake up, or that's what we're going to be in. And many of, so that's just more proof that many of God's people are going to be in that captivity. And these are some of those verses that they'll be hearing during that time to help give them hope, because they're going to go, whoa, we're going to wither away and die in this captivity. But no, God gives them hope. They'll die physically, but that's the emphasis they need to be taught, that it's only a physical death, just a quick physical death. And many of them, of course, will be tortured to death, but if they have the right attitude and goal, and realizing in the next moment of consciousness, they'll be in qualifying for God's kingdom if they get back to God's law. Notice the book of James now, the New Testament. James, James chapter 4. James chapter 4. And let's just look at one verse, because this applies to all of us, brethren, right now concerning God's law. Regardless of what aspect of the law it is, or whatever law we're breaking and we're aware of it, or even some that we may not be aware of, that were laws, but we need to look at this, because we are without excuse if we're under judgment right now. In James chapter 4 and verse 17, it says, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. That was going to be the title of this message. It was going to be, to him who knows. See, that would have been a good title, I suppose. But I didn't. I put it the waking up process, because I think that better described it. But verse 17, meditate on this, brethren. Therefore, to him or her who knows to do good. So if you know to do something that's in righteousness, you know, right doing, keeping God's law, and you're not doing it, then it is sin to you. It is sin. So something to think about always. Notice now Luke chapter 12, something that kind of ties in with this. Definitely does. with this principle anyway. If you know to do, if you know to do good and you don't do it, and then it's sin to you. Luke chapter 12, and let's begin. I want to back up actually because there's some good information here that leads up to it. So let's begin in verse 35, and we have a few verses to read here. It says, "Let your waist," that's Luke 12:35, "let your waist be girded and your lamps burning." See, so you can see. That's why. That's indicative of God's Spirit. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, he may open to him immediately. We'll pause there because I had put in my notes a while back, Revelation 3:20. That's where Christ says, "I'm standing at the door and knocking, and to him who opens, I will come in and dine or feed you." That's where our feeding comes from, is Jesus Christ. So note what it says there at the last part of this verse, that when he comes and knocks, see, Christ is the one who knocks, that may open to him immediately. So in other words, without hesitation. So many today that wake up are beginning to respond rather quickly to this website and the message going out. It's not so much the website, it's the message they're in. Certainly it's not to me they're responding. Hopefully it's the message. Verse 37, "Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching." See, you got to be awake and alert to do that. "Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them." Now, this is the kind of God, brethren, that we serve, that he's going to come before us, gird himself, and serve us. Isn't that humbling? What a humbling thing to think about, that our great God, creator, the author and finisher of our faith, our Savior, is going to come and serve us. That just brings tears to my eyes to think about that. Verse 38, "And if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants." Verse 39, "But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into." So here's a warning. "Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." So we have many today that claim they know when Christ is going to return, but Christ says otherwise. He says, our God says otherwise. You don't know. We can speculate. We can know the season and maybe even narrow it down to approximately months, but other scriptures show you don't know the day or hour. So we may know at some point close to that. I think we just have to be alert and watch the signs and have faith and let Christ lead us, because that's how we're going to make it into God's kingdom, by Jesus Christ, not by any man. It's going to take a lot of faith. That's what I've been trying to put emphasis on off and on here for months. It all comes down to faith. Notice Romans chapter 14 touches on this. Actually, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead here. I'm not finished reading in Luke 12. I apologize for that. Yeah, because there was something I wanted to tie into that last scripture that I gave in James 4:17, that principle of knowing to do good and you don't do it, it's sin. Let's continue where I was left off there in verse 41 of Luke 12. It says, "Then Peter said to him, Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people? And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give him their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes." See, ruling his household. Verse 44, "Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler of that he has." Verse 45, "But if that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of the servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him." See, we get our mind on the wrong thing. "And at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers." Now notice verse 47, because this ties in with James 4:17. Verse 47 says, "And when that servant who knew his master's will," see, he knew his master's will, "and did not prepare himself or do according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes." So see, that ties in with what's mentioned there in James 4:17. It's the same principle. To him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. Well, this is what happens in this case. See, this servant knew his master's will. See, he knew that. We should know what the Lord's will is today. But he did not prepare himself or do according to his master's will. See, So he was beaten with many stripes. That means he's going to have to go in the tribulation. Okay, now, that's the point I wanted to bring out there to correlate that. But now turn, please, to Romans chapter 14. Down through beginning in verse 17, he's talking here about not judging people according to what they eat or drink. And that's the subject there, but the principle he concludes with is dynamic and applies to anything. And if you notice, verse 23 of chapter 14 of Romans, he concludes this verse, this chapter, by saying, "But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith." Now listen to this. This is the principle. "For whatever is not from faith is sin." Whatever is not from faith is sin. So see, it takes faith to tithe, and especially if you're in a bad financial situation and you don't think it can't possibly work out when you work it out on paper. But God says, "Try me." See, that's the same with all of his laws. All of his laws tie and interweave and dovetail together. And when we keep all of those laws, it will make us complete, see, with God's help. It will help make us complete. So whatever is not of faith is of sin. So if you don't have faith to keep God's law, then there's something that has to be repented of there. And ask for more faith. Notice 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, just one verse here. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in verse 34, it says, "Awake." Now see, that means you have to stop right there. Awake means you must evidently be, or we must, whoever's being addressed here, is asleep. So it says, "Awake to righteousness, to right doing." So that means somebody was sleeping and sinning, or not doing righteousness or right doing. So awake to righteousness or right doing, and do not sin. For some do not have the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. He was addressing God's people. See, that's the same today. And this message is going out to many of God's people. And it's a message of correction for all of us. It is certainly for me. I'd like to point out something too in Hebrews chapter 10 that I was talking to Mr. Leary yesterday for over an hour, and what a wonderful conversation that was. But I was discussing what I was tossing around in my head for this message. I hadn't had it, I didn't have it straight in my head yet. Actually, I really never do until a message comes, and I just get on my knees and pray and ask God, and it goes from there. But he had emailed me back and suggested, because we had discussed the general theme of what this message was going to be, and he suggested using the scripture, so I'm going to, because it ties right in with it. It certainly does. So Hebrews chapter 10, and if you'll begin in verse 37, it says, "For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come, and he will not tarry." See, that's what's going to happen. He's going to come suddenly. Verse 38, "Now the just shall live by what? Faith." See, that's what it's all coming down to, friends and brethren. See, if it's not of faith, then it's sin. "The just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back," or as the old King James says, shrinks back. So if you know to do good and you draw back from it, God says, "My soul has no pleasure in him." Verse 39 says, "But we are not of those who draw back into perdition." See, that's destruction, because many are going to go into that. "But of those who believe to the saving of the soul." That's what we want to get to. So it's a good admonition there. God has no pleasure in those who draw back or shrink back. And in order to shrink back from something or draw back from it, you have to be there first and have the knowledge and understanding of it. So if we know to do good and we do it not, then it's sin. See? Notice now Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13, and just one verse here. Verse 11. It says, "And do this." Do this, all of us. Me, all of us, brethren. "Do this, knowing the time that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now our salvation is nearer than we first believed." Well, it certainly is nearer than we first believed, brethren. So that's a good admonition there. It's high time to wake up out of sleep. And it is a process. It is a process. But it can also be speeded up if we do our part. Notice something I meant to mention earlier, but we'll turn there now. It's a good time, I guess. Mark chapter 13. Mark chapter 13. And beginning in verse 35 of Mark 13, as Christ says here, "Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning." Notice verse 36. "Lest, coming suddenly, he find you," what? "Sleeping." See? And so, something to indicates there is that he's definitely going to be coming suddenly, and he's going to be finding some sleeping, and hopefully it's not us, brethren. We want to be awake as much as we can. And like again, I've mentioned before, we don't know what degree that we have to be awake, or what it means to be truly fully awake. Only Christ does. Verse 37 goes on to say, "And what I say to you, I say to all, watch." And so, see, with the exclamation point there. And so, in order to watch, again, you have to have your eyes open. So we go back to conclude here. I'm running out of time, but I wanted to cover some other things Mr. Armstrong said, but I'm going to have to wrap it up here. But let's just conclude in Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3, verse 20, Jesus Christ says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him, and he with me." So that's not referring to physical food, brethren. That's where our feeding comes from. That table of the Lord, see, that spiritual food comes from Jesus Christ. So if we open that door, and as other scriptures I mentioned, open it quickly, see, and then he'll come in and feed us. And that's where our feeding is. But it begins back over here in order to get to that stage. See, verse 17 says, "Because you say," he's talking to this era, "I'm rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing." See, and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Blind, that means your eyes are closed, see? That's why he says in verse 18, "I counsel you," this is our loving God, our Savior, "to buy for me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich," see, spiritually rich, "and white garments, that you may be clothed," that's righteousness or right doing, "that the shame of your nakedness," and nakedness is a type and symbolic of rebellion, "may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see." So if we can see, then we can fulfill and answer verse 20 and open that door for Jesus Christ to come in, and he will feed us, brethren. And then finally, it says in verse 21, which is God says this to every era of the church, "Who overcomes, to him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." But that concludes this message, friends and brethren. And again, it was just an overview. Just wanted to touch on some basic principles about about the waking up process. Is that it's not something that we come to all at once. It's a process. Some people may wake up sooner than others. Some may not have been as asleep as others over the years. One thing is for sure, Jesus Christ says in Matthew 25, verse 5, that we all, ALL, slumbered and slept. So no one can say, without lying, no one can say that they never fell asleep. And Jesus Christ said, indeed, all did. So we're in a waking up process. Some may wake up sooner than others. Some may be more fully awake than others. We certainly don't judge each other based on that. We thank God for his grace and mercy that we can even begin to see that what we have to get back to in waking up. And that's the all things, that wonderful table of spiritual food that Jesus Christ laid so wonderfully for over 50-something years in the 20th century, and it's still there, still preserved, and that truth never changes. Jesus Christ says, "I am the eternal, I change not." So, again, that will conclude this message, brethren. Until next time, do take care. I love you all.